The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
To another episode of Thought Crime Radio. Today we have on the phone with us Patricia Robinette, my co-host.
Hi,
Patricia. And Evelyn Pringle. Evelyn Pringle is an investigative journalist from Wisconsin who has been investigating the very profitable industry of psychiatric child abuse. Evelyn, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right.
Hi, Evelyn. Hi.
So on most of most of the show, we've spent in the past umpteen months talking about obstetrical child abuse. There's lots of different types of medical child abuse going on. Psychiatric is probably the most extreme. Possibly. I'm not sure. It's hard to say. When you compare it with birth trauma, imprinting, and so on, and circumcision, it's hard to say which is worse. You guys, before we get into the substance of the show, I was wondering if I could do a headline segment?
Sure, fine with me.
Sure.
Okay. This is a bit of a rant. I've been reading too much news from the past few days. Anyway, a few weeks ago on this show, I interviewed Jane Graham, a survivor of the Oklahoma City bombing, bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. And I played a collection of local TV news bulletins from that day, which is local to Oklahoma City, which clearly showed that at least three military-grade bombs had been placed in the basement of the building, two of which were duds later removed by the police under the gaze of the local TV news cameras and broadcast for all to see. In other words, Timothy McVeigh's fertilizer truck bomb was a decoy for the real explosives which destroyed the building. Jane pointed out that she had seen three strangers in the parking garage with bricks of black putty and wire pointing to locations within the garage and referring to something which Jane called plans. Unfortunately, I was running around the studio trying to fix a phone problem and missed an opportunity to elucidate what she meant by the word plans. But in other interviews, which you can find on video.google.com, if you Google Jane Graham, you can find out that she's talking about blueprints. And while you're there, you can also see the TV news broadcasts for yourself by, again, going to video.google.com and searching for the three words OKC bombing rare. It should also be noted that Danny Colson, a former high-level official at the FBI, called for a grand jury investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing in 2007, stating that, quote, there were very strong indicators that other people were involved. And, of course, nothing happened with that. Also, you can search for WTC bombing rare and listen to Dan Rather report that the explosives used in the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, which killed six people, were supplied by an FBI informant at the specific direction of his FBI handler over the informant's own objections. In other words, the Oklahoma City bombing, which murdered 168 innocents, including 19 children under the age of six, and the World Trade Center bombing, which killed six people, were false flag operations which helped push through Clinton's anti-terrorism and effective death penalty act and ushered in the bright, shiny new replacement for the Cold War, which was the war on terror, of which 9/11 is the centerpiece. Interestingly, a number of high-level government officials have openly proclaimed the usefulness of a new terrorist attack in propping up public support for sitting presidents, including both Bush and Obama in recent years. Most recently, Robert Shapiro, a former Clinton Commerce Department undersecretary, last week told the Financial Times that, quote, the bottom line here is that Americans don't believe in President Obama's leadership. He has to find some way between now and November of demonstrating that he is a leader who can command confidence and, short of a 9/11 event or an Oklahoma City bombing, I can't think of how he could do that. And you can find that if you Google Robert Shapiro bottom line. Robert Shapiro bottom line. And likewise, Zbigniew Brzezinski gave testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 2007, outlining what amounts to a public relations strategy for mounting a military assault on Iran by blaming U.S. failures in Iraq on Iranian interference. He stated, quote, a plausible scenario for a military collision with Iran would involve Iraqi failure to meet the benchmarks, followed by accusations of Iranian responsibility for the failure, then by some provocation in Iraq or a terrorist act in the United States blamed on Iran, culminating in a defensive U.S. military action against Iran that plunges a lonely America into a spreading and deepening quagmire, eventually ranging across Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. The original Senate.gov site that had this document, it's been taken down, but you can still find it on archive.org, and I'll put the link up in the blog. And while I'm talking about the blog, I keep saying I'm going to put stuff on the blog, but I only got the password back to the blog last night, so I haven't been able to keep it updated since May. I'm sorry about that. I will definitely remedy that situation tonight when I get home. So the blog is thoughtcrimeradio.blogspot.com. In other news, recently declassified documents show that by 1968, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee knew that the Tonkin Gulf incident, which started the money laundering operation known as the Vietnam War, had probably never actually happened and was a fabrication of U.S. intelligence agencies. Of course, we now know that the specific attack, which led to the deaths of 58,000 American soldiers and over 3 million Vietnamese soldiers and civilians, never actually happened. You can Google After Good Senate Tonkin Declassified, and NSA releases History of American SIGINT, S-I-G-I-N-T, American SIGINT, NSA. Anyway, I'll put it on the blog. And just to put all this in a more contemporary context, the United States is currently wasting vast amounts of money, manpower, and resources on a questionable, unwinnable, and already failed war on drugs, which has decimated our families and communities and financed the rise of organized crime and government corruption, all in the context of repeated revelations that U.S. federal agencies have been involved in cocaine and heroin smuggling for years. The war on drugs amounts to a war on the people of the United States, a domestic destabilization campaign which simultaneously raises money for covert operations while selectively decimating those communities that have been traditionally targeted by eugenicists. Eugenics is alive and well in this world, and it uses wealth as a proxy for genetic fitness. We are also waging an endless war in Iraq based on forged yellowcake uranium documents and Bush administration lies about WMDs. Why are we still there? We are engaged in a remote-controlled mass murder in Afghanistan based on the 9/11 deception, which murdered 3,000 people, which, according to the Pentagon rank and file, which, according to Alan Sabrowski, the former director of strategic studies of the U.S. Army War College, is now known to have been a false flag operation by the Pentagon rank and file. So why are we not prosecuting the traitors and foreign intelligence agencies who committed this act? And soon we will be throwing away the lives of young and patriotic but misinformed American soldiers in a pointless war on Iran, which is based in part on documents which U.S. intelligence analysts have already determined to be forgeries from a foreign government. You can Google, intelligence found Iran nuke document was forged. Intelligence found Iran nuke document was forged. Obviously, if the people of the United States are to salvage a shred of their tattered dignity or constitutionally mandated civil rights from the psychopathocrats, what we really need is a war on high-level treason in this country. And we can start by demanding that Congress protect whistleblowers such as Thomas Drake, who did his patriotic duty by exposing treasonous government spying without warrants on constitutionally protected American citizens. Congress need only subpoena Drake to testify in open session, which would simultaneously reveal the truth to the people, confer immunity on Drake, and open the door to the prosecution of the criminals who allowed it. The treason is happening every day, right under our very noses, and financed by our own tax dollars. Given that all of these wars are based on lies, and that they will all end in pointless tragedy, failure, massively increased public debt, and a loss of national and economic security, it follows that all of these wars are in themselves treasonous and are being pursued for treasonous ends. Think about it. If the consequences of an action are known, then the intent of that action is revealed by those known consequences. It's naive in the extreme to think that the sexually mutilated and emotionally castrated psychopaths who have controlled U.S. foreign policy for decades, who have honed their criminality in countless coups, massacres, and torture sessions in the Third World, could possibly forego the temptation of applying their skills in the United States. It would be a grave mistake to think that these people are delusional super patriots. They are traitors. They have a history of treason dating back to Hitler and before. They control our monetary system via the Federal Reserve Act, and their intent is revealed by the predictable consequences of exporting our jobs abroad and destroying the dollar. We are now living through the shock doctrine, okay? And it was all bought and paid for by a Ponzi scheme. It's time to start acting like adults, as though we actually care about our children's future. There's at least one difficult but not impossible way out: to boycott Federal Reserve notes. Create local currencies or forgo currencies altogether. Get to know your neighbors. Support our local farmers. We're going to need them. And support the proposed American Monetary Act at monetary.org. We are being enslaved by fear created by the terrorist network which has infiltrated the federal government. And by the way, if you value the access to information that the internet provides to real journalists, you better start paying attention to the impending assaults on internet freedom, which are being mounted by the same interests which have already done so much to destroy this country and its founding legal framework. Go to savetheinternet.com, savetheinternet.com. So, now let's go back to exposing American medicine's war on children, which we've been documenting for months on this show. Evelyn, you've developed quite a reputation on the net for your investigative reports dealing with the drugging and abuse of children under psychiatric diagnoses, for want of a better word. That's the word they use. You were actually consulted by Senator Grassley in his investigation into research corruption of psychiatric research corruption, right?
Right, yeah, he's been, you know, investigating the money flowing between the pharmaceutical industry and academics, you know, at major universities that do research and then write articles and papers and journals and things. And his staff contacted me about the work I had done on investigating Teen Screen, that drugging dragnet that they were putting in schools to saying under the rules of suicide prevention, that really all it was a recruitment scheme for psych drugs. You know, they wanted to put it in every school in the U.S. and screen every kid in high school for mental disorders. And his staff had read some of the work that I did on that. And I was quick to inform them that the article, the one specific article they sent to me, was rather old, and that I told them they were behind the times, because when I started this investigation, we were talking about saving teenagers from these pharmaceutical industry scams. And I said we were down now to infants and toddlers. We were way below teen screen.
Man, so when did this whole drugging campaign start against? I guess it started with adults, right? Back in the mid-90s, pretty much?
Well, you know, it actually started earlier than that. And you have to remember that drug companies know when they're going to be having drugs come out, new drugs come out. And it started with the new generation of psych drugs, that the Prozac was the first one in December of 1987. And they started revving it up then with getting all their front groups together, you know, these patients, supposedly advocacy groups, and getting them together to market this new generation of psych drugs, which started with Prozac, then with Zoloft and Paxil and Effexor. And then in the early 90s, in like 93, I believe it was, they started coming out with the new antipsychotics, and they needed to market those too. And then it was right in the mid-90s that they also started to market anti-seizure epilepsy drugs as supposedly mood stabilizers to help people with these mental disorders. And so there was a whole big, like I say, new generation of psych drugs. And so that's what they really put all these different marketing schemes together, and they started really gaining steam for kids in the mid-90s, because, you know, they got away with this diagnosing with ADHD and did a pretty good job with that in the 70s and 80s, starting in the late 70s and then through the 80s, and they found out, you know, that was a pretty good trick there, to that parents were going for it, schools were going for it, everything, that these kids had ADHD, and they marketed stimulants for that. And so they had new generations of psych drugs, so they thought, well, none of them were approved for kids for anything, but they thought, well, let's get the kids in on this, you know. So they got all these, I call, highly paid quacks to run these bogus studies and then publish them, you know, have ghostwriters write the papers and put them in reputable medical journals and say that they worked for kids. And they got around the FDA, you know, regulatory scheme, where none of these drugs were approved for use with kids, but as long as they got these highly paid quacks to write these papers and put them in medical journals saying they worked with kids, and then take these papers, these studies, and go around the country and teach prescribing doctors to prescribe them to kids, then they got away with this, just selling these drugs and drugging these kids with these new psych drugs. And even though none were approved for kids until December of 2003 was the first time that any one of those drugs was approved for kids, and that was Prozac, and that was the only one that was ever approved for kids.
What kind of money is flowing into these researchers' pockets from these?
Oh, millions of dollars. Millions of dollars. Like, say the top three at Harvard, Biederman, Spencer, and Willens, and they were all the ones running these tests for these kids and psych drugs and publishing these papers. Between them, it was, I know it was over $1 million each that they didn't report, the grass they found.
How is that
possible? I mean, we're not talking about a few thousand here and there. Millions of dollars was flowing. And it's funny, because he investigated different universities and different fields of medicine, but the psychiatric field was the most, you know, the most infected with conflicts of interest and all this hidden money from the drug companies going to these highly paid quacks, as I call them.
I'd like to read a quote from U.S. House investigation in 1992, quote from Representative Patricia Schroeder of Colorado. She stated, she summarized her committee's findings as follows, quote, "Our investigation has found that thousands of adolescents, children, and adults have been hospitalized for psychiatric treatment they didn't need, that hospitals hire bounty hunters to kidnap patients with mental health insurance, that patients are kept against their will until their insurance benefits run out, that psychiatrists are being pressured by the hospitals to increase profit, that hospitals infiltrate schools by paying kickbacks to school counselors who deliver students, that bonuses are paid to hospital employees, including psychiatrists, for keeping the hospital beds filled, and that military dependents are being targeted for their generous mental health benefits. I could go on, but you get the picture. This was in 1992, and now we have this so-called mental health parity clause in Obama's health bill. You can imagine, this has really opened the floodgates.
Oh, you betcha. And it's like we have two different governments working here, okay? We've got, like, Grassley's investigation over here busting all these people for doing this, for drugging everybody on Medicaid and Medicare and the veterans and stuff. I mean, this is what they went after, targeted, you know, because about 70% of the psych drugs are paid for with Medicaid, with public health care programs. So we got Grassley going after them because that's what caught his attention, you see, because his committee oversees Medicaid and all the public health care spending, and all of a sudden they started noticing that all over the country, the state Medicaid budgets were being broke because everybody was being put on psych drugs. And it was like, well, what is going on here?
But it wasn't...
why is this happening?
Yeah, it wasn't
and
concern
And then they charged
over...
us outrageous prices for them. Yeah. So that's what drew the focus in on them.
Initially, it wasn't concern over the children's welfare. It was just the money flows that brought their attention.
It was the concern of the money flow. And it started out, you know, it started showing up with older people in nursing homes. I mean, they're drugging everybody. But... you know, the law. He started doing this investigation, I think it was in 2004, 2005, because I started covering it right from day one. And that was about grants going to state governments, unrestricted grants, and they were finding out that looking into whether the drug companies were paying this money into there so they could get their psych drugs on these lists of formularies that would be covered by Medicaid. And so that's where it started. But then as they got looking into it, this is why I say they have, like, two governments, because he's looking into this stuff, and you'd think that would slow it down, but it didn't. They got worse. I mean, the kids got younger.
So what is the financial structure of the flows into psychiatry from the pharmaceutical industry? I mean, we have, they subsidize the journals by buying expensive advertising.
Right, and then plus when they publish these studies in there, which we now know, like, I think it's up to like 70% of the studies for those psych drugs were ghostwritten. They were ghostwritten by writers hired by the pharmaceutical industry, and then the paper would be sent back to them to approve it. Then they would send it to one of the quacks that they hired to pay $1,000 or $2,000 to put their name on it, make like they wrote it. And then it gets published in these journals, and the journals, they'd also know that the pharmaceutical industry was going to, you know, buy probably 100,000 or 200,000 copies of this. So, you know, they'd make all the money off of that, and they knew it, because then they were going to use it with sales reps to bring to all the doctors in the country.
Yeah, and they also subsidize the actual conventions, don't they? They have generous donations to these psychiatric conventions where...
oh, absolutely. You know, and Grassley reeled in on that. That was my latest work I did on the front groups, as I call them, and these professional associations, like that American Psychiatric Association. Well, he zeroed in on them, and then it came out, where did it come out of... In 2006, I think it was, they got a third of their funding from the pharmaceutical industry. When I figured it out, it came out to over $20 million in 1 year from the pharmaceutical industry, the American Psychiatric Association.
Didn't they make
it? And then when he went after the front groups, like the patient advocacy groups, NAMI, the National Association of for the Mentally Ill, the biggest one, they got, what did they get? I think it was 23 or 28 million in 1 year,
It should be pointed out that NAMI is not a group of psychiatric patients by and large, but relatives of psychiatric patients.
Right.
And there's a crucial difference there because, you know, miraculously enough, you know, I know this is a violation of the brain disease chemical imbalance religion.
Fairy tale.
You know, somehow mental illness is very closely associated with domestic abuse. How can that be? Gee, I wonder.
Well, you know, what was I just reading today? Something about that. Oh, I was reading an interview with this Danny Carlott, who I feel very duped by. He's been going around and he really has made the world think that he's kind of a psychiatrist that has revised his errors of his ways, you know, that yes, everybody has been on the payroll of the drug companies, including him, going around for a year giving drug company talks for Effexor and making like $30,000 or something like that. And then he decided how you know, he really was on their payroll and it wasn't good. He had to say what they wanted him to say and everything, even though he knew it wasn't true. Well, anyhow, yeah, he's talking. I thought he was one of these that was going to say, well, yeah, he's quick just dishing out pills with these four and five people in 1 hour appointments, you know, in 1 hour to make all that money. But in this interview, he's still doing that. And it was really sad because he said that here's a, for instance, that he was seeing a woman for a year and prescribing sleeping pills for her, an elderly woman, and he didn't find out for a year that she was drinking a lot of alcohol at night with these sleeping pills. And I'm like, and I'm thinking, well, you're a shrink and you're prescribing drugs like this for an elderly woman who it can be lethal with alcohol, and you're actually taking her money for a year to prescribe these drugs and you never even realize that? I mean, that's how little questions I'm saying to ask of what's going on in people's life.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, it's scary.
Patricia, do you want to jump in here?
And another one was, I think that he diagnosed somebody bipolar or something like that, and that's what came to mind when you said the domestic abuse. But then he found out a long time afterwards that here the guy had went through a bad divorce and had been involved in domestic violence or and had drank or something. And I'm thinking, and you didn't know this when you diagnosed them bipolar?
No, of course not. It's all about brain chemicals, you know. It's like,
I mean, yeah,
these people are applying.
Still going with this, like you said, chemical imbalance BS.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't believe this.
It's a fantasy. It's totally made up. It's not science
at
all.
And they basically admitted it. And here on the internet, I had read excerpts from his book he just came out with. And now I'm realizing that all of this that he's been doing for the last year or whatever has been just a line because he's going to have this book coming out. And if you would wait it, he admits this, that there is no such thing. But now in the interview, as a, you know, a chemical imbalance in the brain, and now in the interview, though, he says he still lies to patients and leads them to think there is.
Patricia, do you want to jump in here?
Well, you know, I listened to this talk about chemical imbalance from psychologists and psychiatrists, and what occurs to me is that it really matters how we eat, because that really is the basis of our chemical makeup. And the way that Americans eat really is not conducive to physical health or mental health, either one. So sugar is really, you know, very detrimental for thinking clearly and being peaceful. And meat makes people feel angry and anxious, because there's adrenaline that shoots through the body of the animal when it's killed. So, you know, there is some kind of imbalance, but I think it starts really at the table with what we put in our mouths with our forks, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think that any amount of drugging is going to fix that. It's really going to have to be that we just start eating really clean food, simple food like animals are made to eat, because our bodies are animal. And you know, other primates eat half fruit, mm-hmm. raw, of course, and half greens, raw, of course. And we eat Hostess Twinkies and, you know, breakfast cereal with sugar. And then they make studies. The sugar industry pays somebody to make a study to prove that sugar does not create hyperactivity in children, which every mother laughs at very hard. So that's my little two cents.
In a broader sense, though, the brain is a information processing neural net, okay? And it's true that tweaking chemicals in the brain can affect its actions, but the most powerful aspect is learning. You know, that's the brain learns about the world around it, you know, through its prior experiences. And if you take a child and abuse it for years and years and throw it into a classroom that has very boring curricula and doesn't teach him anything and the information is irrelevant to his daily life, and then you wonder why he falls asleep or acts out, it's not hard to figure this out. I mean, you can tweak his chemicals till he's blue in the face and incapacity, you know, this is what psychiatry does, is it blocks normal brain function in order to control behavior. And sometimes it involves permanent damage to the brain, sometimes not. But that really is how psychiatry approaches the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I have a recording of Peter Bregan. Peter Bregan is a dissident psychiatrist who's pretty well known.
He can call the conscience of psychiatry for a long time, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he's really good. This is from an interview in the mid '90s, I'll just play a short segment here.
My wife and I have a third book that's been recently published called The War Against Children, which is about racism in federal government programs, and particularly racism aimed at black children in federal government psychiatric programs. And in that book, The War Against Children, I have a chapter on the history of the role of psychiatry in Nazi Germany, and very, very documented, like all my stuff is. And this subject I'm about to introduce you to, I have actually lectured on in Germany as well as in other European countries. I've given this talk at a historical conference on medicine in Germany. So this is very valid material that I'm presenting to you. Psychiatry was key in the whole developmental process of the Holocaust. It all begins in the late 1930s and early 40s with the extermination of mental patients by psychiatry. Psychiatry created five, six euthanasia centers, words people haven't heard of, Hartheim, Sonnenstein. These extermination centers used gas chambers, at the time carbon monoxide. They used fake soap. They used not so much cremating ovens as they cremated the bodies in pits. That was one of the differences. But they had the whole works, and they had euthanasia forms that they used to fill out in Berlin on patients who were in the local state mental hospitals, and then they were shipped, the patients selected, were shipped to the killing centers. This is what proved to Hitler and to the German bureaucracy that you could carry out a mass extermination, a bureaucratic, technological mass extermination. It was proven and demonstrated by psychiatry.
Wasn't there a psychiatrist who actually spoke to Hitler and about this very thing? I mean, it wasn't just like Hitler read about it. Wasn't there a psychiatrist who actually...
Well, anyway, didn't mean to go over there. Anyway, that is extremely well backed up. It's not something you'll see in the newspaper. But somehow, no matter how much abuse is heaped on the underclasses of the world by psychiatry, they always seem to have this Teflon coating. They probably mostly because the whole psychiatric profession is implicitly involved in supporting the social status quo. That's what it's really about. You could really think of it as the church of the status quo. It worships the social status quo. If a person is poor, poorly educated, unhappy in their lives, it's because they have something is wrong with them. Nothing is wrong with society. You see, we live in a utopian society here, and everybody should be happy. And if you're not happy, it means something is wrong with you. Even if you are, an abused child or a poor person who can't, send their children to college or whatever, it's always your fault. So it's really just a dressed up form of blaming the victim. So I understand Florida has now gone to the forefront of protecting children that are in foster care from psychiatric abuse. Have you been following that, Evelyn?
Yeah, I'm following it. I've just come out now that the latest thing is that they said that they aren't going to allow any foster children to be involved in clinical trials of psychiatric drugs. Well, the thing about it is Florida's a good place to start, I'll tell you, because Florida has been one of the drugging capitals of the United States as far as kids. I mean, it all came to a head here, it was in 2009, yeah, 2009, when this little Gabriel Myers hung himself, and he was 7 years old, and he was on, at the time of his death, he was on Vionize, a stimulant drug, and he was on a Symbiax, which was a combination of the antipsychotic Zyprexa and Prozac together. Now, both of those comes with suicide warnings, that they can cause kids to, you know, become suicidal. And so, and it was so sad because, I mean, you think of a seven-year-old hanging himself. Now, what little seven-year-olds are thinking of this? Now, he was in foster care. And it was so sad, I wrote about it, and one of the most alarming thing was the psychiatrist that prescribed these drugs to him, and in the year before this, he had been on a number of other drugs, too, Zyprexalone, Lexapro, and I think one other drug, too. And he didn't even remember the child, the psychiatrist. He couldn't even... He couldn't even say whether he had treated him or not. Well, he had, because that's what's in the medical record. But here's this little boy that hangs himself on those adult drugs that weren't approved for him, and the guy don't even remember him. And so, you know, Florida now is, that started out a whole bunch of investigations and stuff into the how many kids were being drugged in Florida. But this has really been going on in Florida for a lot of years. I mean, I think the first report out on drugging foster children was back, I think it was in 2003. So we're now in 2000. It took in 2009 with this little kid hanging himself. And when I reported on this last year, I went back and Medicaid records had showed it was either 2007 or 2008 that there was, Medicaid records showed there was 23 children under the age of one that had been prescribed antipsychotics. And when I went through and broke down this report that was under the age of five, there was 115 children under the age of five that doctors in Florida had diagnosed with schizophrenia, which is unheard of in children, you know, and in children, but under the age of five. Can you imagine that? 115. But see, doctors have to justify prescribing those antipsychotics.
Yeah.
So to do that, they label 115 kids five and under with schizophrenia for...
Sorry about that, guys. We were preempted by the forces of nature here. Just to give the listener an idea of the absolute lack of scientific credibility of psychiatric research, or at least some psychiatric research, back in 2007, some rocket scientist psychiatrists were doing... brain scans of children who had been diagnosed with ADHD. You know, this brain scans. This is really the new phrenology that has been embraced by psychiatry. They're looking for structural differences in the brains of people who have been who have fallen afoul of psychiatric standards, and trying to justify their organic approach to human suffering by looking for differences in people's brains. So they were scanning the brains of these kids who had been diagnosed with ADHD. And this research was actually published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is like the premier peer-reviewed, top-notch scientific publication in the United States, okay? And somehow this thing passed the peer review process. I suppose this is typical. They found differences in the brains, structural differences in the brains of children who had been diagnosed with this. So I went and dug this up, this paper, and in about 10 minutes of reading the paper, I discovered that they had two groups. You know, they had a control group of normal kids, quote unquote, and they had another group of ADHD kids. And all of the ADHD, or I'm sorry, 66% of the ADHD children had in fact received a diagnosis of ADHD and thus been drugging. They had been drugging them with stimulants like Ritalin. So the kids who had structural differences in the brains had been receiving drugs which were well known to produce precisely the changes that they were detecting in these brain scans. You know, they were basically proving that they were damaging these children's brains. This is not uncommon in psychiatric research when they have a control group and a psychiatric group. Frequently, you will find that the psychiatric group has been treated with psychiatric drugs which are known to produce structural differences in the brain without controlling for this fact. And this was published in the primo scientific journal in the United States. That's just unbelievable. The whole, you know, edifice of scientific credibility is crumbling, especially in psychiatry, but also in medicine. In medicine in general, medicine has been trying for years to find a justification for cutting off the foreskins of little baby boys, and they are just dreaming up one myth after another to do so, and they all fall down when you actually look at it. Anyway, I just had to do some ranting there.
They just don't think very deeply. You know, they stay on the surface and ask easy questions, but they don't really get down to the guts of it and what's really going on with people and with health, you know, physical and mental. They just don't ask the right questions. And then the answers are also very superficial.
Evelyn, what do you anticipate is going to happen as a result of the inclusion of the mental health parity clause in Obama's Health Reform Act?
Well, that's where I go on and I say, I'm always saying there's two governments, because we've got, you know, them doing that, saying, well, yeah, let's give more treatment for mental illness. Let's cover more treatment for mental illness. And on the other side, Grassley investigating how all this is fraudulent. You know, I mean, the drug companies couldn't peddle these drugs without what I call the middleman pushers. And now it's not just psychiatrists. That's the really sad part. They've got these highly paid quacks teaching doctors all over the country in every field of medicine to prescribe these psychiatric drugs to people. You know, I mean, if you would go look at the Medicaid records, you're going to see very few psychiatrists actually writing these prescriptions anymore.
Wow.
They're going to be general practitioners, and they're going to be pediatricians and things writing these prescriptions, because that's what they set out to do, to go and teach these doctors. And, you know, doctors have to have so many hours of education every year. So for many years, what they've been doing is paying that for doctors and paying the highly paid quacks in the field of psychiatry to go and teach all these doctors this and give them this free education. And the payoff is that they're prescribing all these drugs to everybody, psych drugs for everything, for uses that are not approved by the FDA, because they have not provided that. All they need to do is provide two tests that show the drug did a little better than a placebo, and they can't do it. You know, I mean, for these kids especially, I mean, they can't do it for any of those psych drugs for those kids, but yet kids are being prescribed them for everything under the sun. I mean, and they got away with that ADHD with them Ritalin stimulants and stuff, but now they've got doctors prescribing them for them antipsychotics for ADHD. And you know, I know you know this, but like how they switched over from ADHD, that really these ADHD kids in the mid-90s, that they really were bipolar kids. Well, bipolar is the grand kahuna, because that one you prescribe all kinds of drugs for. So that's the method to their madness of wanting to diagnose all these kids bipolar. But the truth is that when they started giving them stimulants for ADHD, well, the stimulants cause mania. So then when they become manic from the stimulants, then they said that they were having mania, like in manic depression, bipolar, and then stimulants make you depressed. Any speed freak will tell you that when you're coming off those stimulants, you are going to be depressed. That's just known. So then you've got the depression coming, and they're saying that that's bipolar then, because you got the mania when the kids go up like that. Then when they're coming down, they got the depression. So then they said now they're bipolar. Well, then they get to prescribe all these drugs for these bipolar kids. I mean, one bipolar kid is a gold mine. I figured out with these drugging guidelines that one of these front groups put together for what drugs to give bipolar kids. And when I did it all down the line in accordance with what they said, it came up to, the drugs cost at drugstore.com, $48,000 a year for one bipolar kid. And that's just the drugs. That's not talking the prescribing shrink or whoever prescribed them or any therapy. So I said, in what field of medicine other than this would parents be conned into forking out $50,000 a year for a diagnosis that couldn't even be verified?
Well, this is being paid for by insurance companies by and large, and by the U.S. government
companies and by Medicaid.
Yeah, right. So I mean,
you know,
you're
so
wondering,
that's
you're wondering
what one bipolar kid is worth to the drug company,
right?
The pharmacy.
You're wondering why we have such an expensive healthcare system in this country, and
you bet. And again, that's what drew Grassley to him, because those psych drugs are so expensive. I mean, I think Abilify, that antipsychotic guy, was $1,200 a month the last time I checked.
Speaking of traumatized people and psychiatrized people, I need to play a short PSA here for the veterans who are currently suffering post-traumatic stress from their massive exploitation and abuse in these wars that this empire is pursuing.
I know what you're going through.
I've been there.
Nobody else I know has been there.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Things at home may be as you left them.
But you don't feel the same.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
And connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Sounds like a lost business for psychiatrists if these veterans to get together and, actually work.
Well, they sure would do a lot better getting together and talking any kind of therapy besides the drugging business. I mean, because that's for PTSD. That's all that is all they recommend is drugs.
I mean, approaching emotional suffering from the viewpoint of tweaking brain chemicals would be analogous to trying to debug a computer with a soldering iron, you know.
That's a good analogy.
I mean, it's true. I mean, the brain is a healing, it's constantly constructing itself. You know, contrary to what psychiatrists were telling us for many decades that, you know, brain damage is forever. I mean, some types of brain damage, for instance, sensory deprivation produced by lack of foreskin, for instance, you can't overcome that. But emotional trauma, things like that can be healed from just by the construction of new neural pathways. And, you know, this is under the control of the individual. But if you approach emotional suffering by tweaking brain chemicals, this is like taking a sledgehammer to a Swiss watch.
Sure, and you know how they've been saying for years that, you know, the reason that they're not providing any therapy, that it's drugging, is because the insurance companies say because it's so expensive to get therapy. Well, I'm telling you something right now. When you're talking about drugs that cost $1,200 a month, you can get an awful lot of therapy for that from a counselor. Like if you had PTSD, you could get an awful lot of talk therapy for that. But here's another thing too, though. Nobody ever does tests on that. They say, we don't know that would work for PTSD because there's no tests on it. Well, no, because nobody's going to profit from the tests on it to show that it works.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, too, if you don't have competent therapists...
Hey, Faulkner, you're listening to...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, if you don't have competent therapists, it's not going to work. You know, I mean, there's another area that I think there should be some kind of test to show that therapists know what they're doing. You know, that they're not just taking patients in there and just letting them sit there and ramble on, that they have some kind of focus to their therapy and some kind of goals, you know, where people can get better.
Or the whole system. Does the whole system actually work? Or is it based on fallacies?
Absolutely.
You can't call people names like bipolar and schizophrenic and things like that and expect them to feel better about themselves and feel peaceful and happy. It's going to make them more fearful. And I just found a statistic here that says that pharmaceutical companies make pills for pennies, and your prescription costs you hundreds of dollars. Their markups can run as high as, listen to this, 134,000